Join us as we gather around the hedge, where we dig into technology, business, and culture with the finest minds in computer networking.
Well, hello, Tom. Now, I'm very disappointed in you today, Tom.
What this time?
Well, I see people's books other than mine behind you in the bookshelf, and that's just not. I think as many books as I've written, you ought to fill your whole bookcase up with my books.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty hard, though. You're right next to internet routing architectures. I mean,
Okay. Well, that's Halabi's. Halabi's not too bad. I'll be okay with being next to Halabi. Yeah, Halabi wrote that. That book, by the way, was the first Cisco Press book ever published.
Oh, I didn't know.
And the second was Advanced IP Network Design.
Nice.
So it's. Oh, look at that.
Right there.
So we're joined today by Nick Carter, who's holding up his copy of Advanced IP Network Design. Oh, my goodness. With a little old-style CCIE logo on the front of it. That's it's well done. All right, Nick, so tell us where you are. You said you're in Bristol, right?
That's right, yeah, Bristol in the UK.
Okay. And where is that in relation to Southampton? North, south? It can't be west.
No, it is. It can't be south of Southampton. It's northwest.
Northwest of Southampton. Okay. I just wondering because I went to Southampton for once. We took off on a Norwegian cruise from there and went up through the fjords and stuff like that. It was really cool. Went up to Iceland and stuff like that. I did not fly through that area when I went to Nuuk. Greenland, I flew from on a Super 8 from a turboprop from Iqaluit, Canada, across the North Atlantic to get to Nuuk. What an amazing flight that was. Anyway, it only flies once a week. So if you fly there, you're there for the whole week. We hope you like it. But anyway,
nice.
That was entertaining. So today we're talking about Flock Networks, which is yet another open source routing project. So why does the world need another open source routing stack, Nick?
Okay. So I would like it to be open source, but it's actually not open source.
At
the moment. So at the minute, it's free to download. And I certainly think in networking, customers are coming to the end of their tether with their proprietary closed source solutions. So it's certainly my intention to make it open source. But obviously, I want to feed the family and I want to sort of pay the bills. So there's the old open source thing of what's the step between there and profit. So so we shall see. I'm being agile on that, and I definitely would like to get some backing and open source it. So the background on it is probably a bit of background on me, how I got there really was I've been working in network for 30 years. Started at Data General, which is a many people remember, but it's been taken over by EMC now. Ran their data network back in the 90s.
So what did Data General make? Didn't they make servers and workstations?
Exactly.
Competing with Sun, correct?
Yeah, so they were part of the mini computer and the Unix wars, and they had DG Unix
So competing with the AS400 as well.
Exactly.
And that line of IBM stuff. Okay.
Yeah. And that was quite an exciting place to be then because the Unix and the Mini were the next big thing, which sort of happened, but never quite took over. Went through a few different companies. I worked at Cisco for 13 years. I was in their advanced services, which was doing sort of professional services to service providers, some pre-sales support, some post-sales support. Worked in the Cisco Ceph forwarding team, which was doing the packet forwarding and the program of the hardware. I was in there
with Bobby Seal and Alan Chalick.
Yes, so Alan Chalick came over and started the UK team and grew it. So I reported to Alan. Then we moved on, quite a few of us moved on to Brocade, who'd taken over Viata. We worked on the Viata code base, which I think was a fork of Zebra. Mm-hmm. And I worked on the data plane there and then the control plane. And then basically when I was coding in C, we were making this sort of God box, which never shipped. It was going to be a huge router with loads and loads of interfaces. But I managed to put a commit in and I managed to take down all the data planes with my commit. And it was just basically because I hadn't checked a value coming down from the controller. And the controller shouldn't have sent that value, but it was my bug. I hadn't checked the value. I was writing in C, had a null pointer. Bang, that was the end of the whole box. And I just thought there must be a better way than this. There must be a better way than the control plane being able to take down the entire database.
This is the problem with God boxes. They're not God.
Yeah. But even if you got, you know, these days, even if you're a spine switch, you don't want to take down a spine switch with a bit of badly formatted control traffic coming down. Yeah, so the database should be just saying no. That got me looking around, and I saw a language called Rust. I'd like to talk more about that if I can. It's just basically a safe version of C. I saw the industry was sort of disaggregating. People were moving towards these routers where you could pick and choose the best of breed, white box, and a mix and match, which seemed to be like a nice model and seemed to be the industry maturing. And I thought I'd like to write a best of breed IP routing stack. And so that's what I've been doing for the last year. I've been doing releases, and I've got BHP support, OSPF v2 support, and Sonic support so far. And then I'm working on v6 and OSPF v3 next. So I'm really just sort of touting it around, demonstrating it, and trying to get some people to use it, really.
So I have to tell you my Alan Shalick story. So we had an ITF in London, and I was in the terminal room. This is back when we had terminal rooms. And Shalick and I were sitting across the terminal room table from one another with the tops of our laptops were literally touching each other. So I'm sitting there answering email and doing stuff. I get an email from Shalick. And it says, want to go to lunch? And I look up. And I'm like, Alan, you know, what's the deal here, dude? So I replied and I said, sure, where? And he replies back. And I'm still sitting here staring at him like, what is going on here? And he says, let's go to the French Deli down the road. I'm like, Alan, this is my first time in London. I'd really like to go to a British pub or something. And he replies and says, no, you wouldn't. We're going to the French place down the street. that's my Shalick story. So nice. You're missing a protocol, though. I don't know if we can allow this to continue.
Well, I suspect you're going to say ISIS, but you should probably say BFD, but I don't know. I'm missing many protocols.
No, you're missing ISIS and the Edge ERP, of course, but, you know, just for old time's sake, you should do Edge ERP.
Yeah. I mean, I think let's not have a podcast about ISIS versus OSPF, please. they're both wonderful in their own way.
Yeah, exactly. As Doug Comer told me, OSPF started out as an attempt to be a simpler ISIS. It didn't work.
That's funny. That's pretty great. Well, it's okay. If EIGRP never makes it into the code, Nick, I wouldn't shed a tear. I don't know about other people.
Oh, come on. EIGRP is a great protocol. So talk to us about Rust. Why Rust? Why are you doing this in Rust? Because I think it's interesting because, of course, I write C with – I touched Smalltalk and XBase and Pascal and Python and Tickle and lots of other languages. But I think I've never actually touched Rust. So what's Rust about?
Rust. I'm super excited about Rust, and I'm not the sort of person to get super excited about the new shiny thing. So same as yourself. I've used many languages over my career, and only Python – C and Rust, and now Rust are sort of stuck for me. Not to say they're the best languages, but I'm saying I don't tend to change languages very often. I mean, I've been writing C, you know, 20 years, and I've been writing Python for 20 years. But Rust came along, and it's a safe version of C, so you don't get those dangling pointer reuse after free errors. You basically don't get the worst class of bug that you get in C, the ones that are really hard to debug, the ones that you hit when the thing's been running in production for maybe, you know, a day or 2 days or a week, you get some memory corruption, and then later it crashes. And I've had experience of trying to debug those sort of issues is a nightmare, very difficult, frustrating, and you do feel like the computer should be helping you a bit. So Rust is a very strict compiler, and if you try and do that, it won't even compile your source code. If you try and leave something that's not initialized, it won't compile. And the basic rule in Rust has something called a borrow checker, and it says you're okay to look at this memory. You can hold a pointer to it if that memory is immutable. and you can hold as many pointers as you like to it if it's immutable. But as soon as you make that memory mutable, you can only have one reference to it. So that is actually pretty restrictive. If you think how you program C, C++.
You call functions with a pointer to a memory location rather than copying the memory location, because memcopy is so expensive. Moving stuff around between processes is so expensive.
Yeah.
And then you just modify it, and the return is yes or no, it succeeded or didn't succeed. And the answer is actually in the memory pointer I handed you to put the answer in.
Yeah.
So it's mutable.
Yeah, it's all mutable. Also, in Rust, you're still passing by reference, definitely, because that's much more efficient. But the Rust, I mean, it's borrowed from different languages. And so in C++, you've got smart pointers. So a Rust pointer is basically a bit like a C++ smart pointer, and it's a fat pointer. So it knows what it points at, but it also knows the size of what it's pointing at. So you don't have the problem of not knowing what the end boundary is on the thing you're passing to the function.
So no length. You don't have to call length constantly to figure out, or the size of, to figure out what you're looking at. You just know what it is.
Yeah. So the pointer itself has a second number of bytes behind it saying this is how long I am, and you don't even see that. So that's nice. And the other nice thing about it is there's no such thing as a null pointer. A pointer is of a type option. They call it an enum in Rust. It's a tagged enum. So if you want to access a pointer, you have to unwrap it, and you either get a result saying this is a valid pointer, or you get no, this pointer doesn't exist. So you can't dereference, and you're forced in, when you're writing the code, you're forced to check that result. You can't just say I know this pointer exists. You have to say, okay, unwrap this pointer. Does it exist? I'll use it. Does it not exist? I'm going to have to handle this error. So the error handling is actually very nice. You'd think, as I'm explaining it, it's a right pain. But you actually fix a lot of corner cases whilst you're coding, because you're forced to consider when things don't work. Rather than just writing the good path, you tend to write the whole path, all paths at once as you understand the code. And you don't get that strange bug 6 months later when you think, what does this code do? I can't remember.
Yeah, cuts off a lot of shortcuts too, right? Like just doing a not pointer if the pointer's to null. And so you're also saying that these pointers are strongly typed. Like you can't have an untyped pointer. You can't. Can you cast between? Can you cast an array to and a pointer to a head of an array to a string or something like that?
So I mean, Rust is a systems program language. So it's got a dirty little secret, which is the unsafe keyword. So you can put unsafe and put brackets, and then anything you do in there then becomes more like C, C++, and you can do what you like. You can share your pointers. You can have immutable references. You can cast, but that's clearly marked as unsafe. And those bits of code tend to be buried deep in the library. So in Rust, you can have a mutex object if you want to take a mutex. That's totally safe to you. But if you look in the mutex library, there'll be a couple of lines of unsafe code there where they actually do the memory barrier work. Someone else has done that. And in terms of auditing the code, it makes it much easier. You just need, if you've got a crash, you only need to audit your unsafe code, because your safe code's never going to crash. So it just makes the thing more manageable. You can cast, as in C, you need to know what you're doing. For instance, it's very expressive as well. So my implementation of OSPF is 12,000 lines, and I've got, I think, less than 10 lines of unsafe code. And that's all where I'm connecting to C libraries. Because if you want to connect to a C library, by definition, that's unsafe, because you need to pass it a C pointer, and you need to get back the contents of the C pointer. And you don't know what that is, so you have to wrap your calls into C in unsafe. So if you make a socket call, if you read or write to a socket, but other than that, all the rest is buried in the standard libraries, and you don't actually need to use unsafe unless you're doing some super optimized stuff.
So when you implemented OSPF, did you do it the kind of the classic way? The first time I saw this was pretty amazing to me, but this was many years ago. But was as a table, a neighbor state table or a state table, like a two-dimensional table where you take your current state as your row or your column, and then you walk across to what the event is in the opposite, whether it's a row or a column, and that gives you the function to call? Or are you doing it something more as a switch statement? How are you actually implementing the way OSPF operates?
I'm doing the switch statement, which is the poor man's version of the finite state machine. So the actual outcome is the same.
Right, of course.
And you need, on your OSPF, you need the two machines. You need a an interface state machine and a neighbor state machine. One thing that Rust can do actually is at compile time, it can you can create state machines that can't get into an illegal state, and it can check that at compile time. So there's an optimization. Yeah, I'll probably move to that at some point. But in terms of getting the thing written, I just use a switch statement for now.
Okay, yeah, cool. I was just curious. Now, this also has implications in security, right? Because this should, in theory, get rid of any buffer overflows, anything like that, right?
Yeah, and it's not just in theory. I think unless there's a bug in the Rust compiler, it is in practice as well. That you can't have the buffer overflow because you know the length of the buffer. And you can't stack smash. You can't use after free. So when they say it's memory safe, they mean safe. I mean, you can leak memory, but that's not considered unsafe. But what you can't do is say, I want to go to this address, and you end up at the wrong address. You're not allowed, unless you use this unsafe keyword, you're not allowed to do pointer arithmetic. So you can't just say, I've got this pointer, and I know this field is 4 bytes off it, so I'm going to add 4 bytes onto this field. And you just cannot do that. The machine code you get will be identical. It's the same as C++ in terms of its runtime, and it uses the same backend on the compiler. But you can't do arbitrary arithmetic on pointers, and that's really what makes it safe.
So I guess you're not doing a lot of fuzz testing or anything like that on this code, because it almost seems pointless, except for the unsafe parts.
I wouldn't say it's pointless. I haven't done any fuzz testing. There are fuzz testing libraries, so I would like to do some. And then in the code, of course, you get these places in code where this can never happen, and you have to panic at that point, because you're saying this state it's just impossible. You know, reasoning as a programmer, you're saying it's impossible to get in this state. And we all know as programmers, at some point you'll get into that state, but you understand why, and you'll need to panic. And I think fuzz testing would be a good way to hit that. You can also hit runtime panics in Rust. So in C, if you access outside of an array, C doesn't care. You'll just get the value at that random memory address and you'll carry on. But in Rust, if you access outside the array, then Rust will panic on you. And then you need to decide what you're going to do with that panic. You can try and carry on, or you can actually really panic. But one thing that can't happen is you can't request from the kernel an address you don't own. So you don't get the one with the, you don't get the segfault error. You don't get the kernel coming and killing you. That's the really bad one in C, is that in C, if you've got a dangling pointer and you go and look at it, chances are it's not even mapped. The kernel sees you looking at unmapped memory, and the kernel will kill you, and you've got no choice over the matter. In Rust, you're probably not going to panic. If you do panic, then it's up to you. You can close your threads down and respawn them and carry on. So I think that's quite a huge difference as well.
Interesting.
So do you have anybody collaborating with you on this, or is it just you right now?
It's only me writing the code. I had a couple of ex-colleagues testing it to start with, and I've got half a dozen people on the internet who've picked it up and who are using it. So it's getting quite good testing, but I'm the only coder. So
nice.
I think the intersection of people who know networking and people who know Rust is quite small at the moment.
I would imagine.
Yeah. But hopefully that'll grow over time.
What kind of, for those who are testing it, what kind of scenarios are they throwing it into?
Well, OSPF came out first, so sort of OSPF and scale. So it's designed to sit basically in a single area. It does support the whole RFC, but it should scale so well. You just put everything in area zero, and make area zero as large as you like, and just simplify things. So people have been doing some scale testing on that, and then BGP I did only about a month ago. And some ISPs are interested in that, and they're testing against BIRD just to see how the performance compares. And as an aside, I've got a white paper on the website, and it sort of talks about the difference between BIRD and Cisco IOS, which were these sort of original routing protocol stacks, which are single threaded and pretty much have their own scheduler built in. And then Juniper Junos and IOS XR, FRR and everyone else who do the sort of the Unix processes, message passing between each other using the kernel. And then the Flock one is a different design enabled by Rust, which is, and if you're a C or a C++ programmer, this is going to sound crazy, but the whole routing suite runs inside a single process. And then each component is a thread. So you have a master BGP thread and a master OSPF thread. And then you can have thread pools inside of those. So you can, inside of your BGP master thread, you have a thread pool where BGP can operate in parallel on the BGP table. So in theory, the performance should be much, much, much faster because I'm passing around references. If you say say BGP wants to send 10,000 routes down to the RIB, I'm passing a 16-byte pointer from BGP to the RIB, whereas most of the routing protocols are copying that data via the kernel in between inter-process communication.
They're actually copying the entire route, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and the 10,000 of them and any metadata that needs to go.
Because it's a context switch, right, between processes, where in your case you're actually using what is this similar to a pthread? Is this what we're looking at, something similar
yes,
to a pthread?
It is a pthread. So that's the other thing about Rust is it's not like Erlang or Go. It's not a green thread. It's actually a pthread on the operating system. And then you pass the reference. And instead of passing a pointer, of course, you're passing this fat pointer. You've got the reference. So you know the type of it. You know the size of it. So that makes it easier. And then in the standard library, they have these lock-free channels for communicating between threads. So you basically, BGP just takes this data, puts a reference to it on this lock-free channel. And whenever RIB has time, it starts pulling events off that lock-free channel and it pulls off those routes. And then but the main thing is the routes themselves just sit in the same memory address in the heap. And there's obviously, you miss the context switching, which speeds you up, but also copying data is very slow and it'll destroy your data cache. So not copying data is huge.
Yeah. Well, you have to do memcopy when you do a context switch because you can't have shared memory between context.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you just physically can't because it has to be because it's mapped by the processor into different memory pools. Everybody in a modern processor, it wasn't this way many, many years ago when I first started coding on TRS-8080 or TRS-80s, believe it or not, and my little 8080 PC writing assembler because there was nothing else. This was before I could even get my hands on a C compiler, before I could get Borland C++ or Borland C. Back then, your memory was constantly mapped. Today, with modern memory mapping, where you have MMUs, memory mapping units in your CPU, everybody actually starts at zero. They don't actually start at zero, but they all think they start at zero. And so there's a memory mapping unit that actually does like NAT for memory locations.
Yeah. But that's the thing. I mean, back in the day, with Cisco IOS, when it was all in the same process, it was all on the same heap. I mean, there's a lot of war stories there about how that was written. And obviously memory protection came in because you really don't want one process stomping on the other process's memory. It's a horrible bug. But with Rust coming along, at compile time, that's prevented. So you take the hit on the compile time and then you have no hit at runtime. So for me, that's something to get very excited about.
Yeah. I remember when I was working in EIGRP, I put in a feature for EIGRP because I never really coded against bugs in EIGRP, just features. So I put in a feature and I ran it as a test. Somebody called me from some customer. I was on global escalation and they said, I want this feature in EIGRP. And I'm like, oh, that's like 15 lines of code. I can go do that. So I did it and I pushed a special to CCO at the time. They downloaded the special. So it had my name on the compile and on my username on the compile. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, my pager went off. And I'm like, what's this? Like, what is going on here? So what had happened was the guy had taken the code that I had sent him as a special, and he liked it so much, the feature he thought was so useful, that he threw it into his core running EIGRP, and then it crashed in X25. So I was getting a stack trace from X25, and I'm like, I have no idea where to even begin stack tracing a crash in X25 when I made a 15-line code change over here in EIGRP. Like, how does that even relate? And it was like some memory stomp thing. It was some uninitialized thing over in X25 and you know, it just so happened that as I increased the size of EIGRP, it stomped on the memory space in X25 and X25 crashed. And the guy didn't even have X25 configured. It was like totally straight.
That's quite impressive, really.
So, I don't know. Very bizarre. So
yeah, that's what I'm saying. If you say to a C programmer, I've put everything in a single process, then they're going to be like, you really, really don't want to do that. And I would have said the same, you know, two years ago, I would have said the same. And when I worked in the Ceph team, we had exactly the same stories. And in fact, IOS used to store the program counter of who allocated the pointer in the end, because it was the only way to find out where this rogue thing had come from. Mm,
that's right. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. There was a program counter on every memory location in the mem header that was added so that you could figure out how many references there were to it. And if it came out to be weird, you would like do a panic. You'd like do an assert and say, no, I've just released this and there are five people still referencing. Something's wrong. Like so there's a problem. Yeah. That was insane. So you said you have people testing. Are they doing CI/CD? Are they doing automated testing? Or is this just more like they're throwing it up in the lab and trying it out?
I think they're throwing it up in the lab. I mean, there's two colleagues of mine. I know what they're doing, ex-colleagues, because I chat to them. But the other people are just email addresses on the internet. So I actually don't really know what they're doing. I get the impression they're pretty highly skilled engineers and they're just throwing it in and seeing what happens. I don't think there's any automation about it. I think they're just saying, let's kick the tires basically and see what this thing does.
What I think is really interesting about Flock then in your whole concept here is kind of what you alluded to at the beginning, which is, you know, things are becoming disaggregated now. And I wanted to get your opinion on something here, Nick. Do you think that we will, because right now, if you look at the open source routing stacks, what I see, and maybe I'm missing something, I see a lot of BGP stacks out there, and I see a smaller subset of more comprehensive stacks, like FRR gives you a bunch of stuff, not just BGP. I don't see, other than that, I don't see a whole lot of a la carte. Like, I'm not aware of any ISIS implementations, like all by themselves, right? And I don't know if you guys are aware of any.
Which makes me sad.
Yeah. So, but do you think, I mean, the benefits you've talked about here with Rust, do you see the industry potentially going that way where somebody says, hey, I can do ISIS in Rust. This is cool. And people will take it up. And what do you think?
Yeah. I have no more knowledge really about where things are going than anyone, but I'd love to see that happen. I think it ought to happen. But I think at the moment, Rust is very small and growing fast. And when you're small, it's very easy to grow fast. So will Rust, will it survive the test of time? If it gets medium size and continues to grow, then I can see that happening. Is C and C++ going away anytime soon? Not in your life. I mean, people will be writing new code in C and C++ in 20 years' time. I'm sure they will. But I think Rust has got some momentum. I think Microsoft did a survey and they looked at their CVEs in Windows and they looked at their C++ CVEs and they said that if that code had been written in Rust, then 70% of those CVEs would have been caught at compile time. So as I understand it, I haven't got any inside information, but only from the public thing, I think they're rewriting parts of Windows now in Rust. It's very easy to call from Rust to C and C to Rust. They've got very similar runtime. I know Amazon are doing Firecracker, which is their virtualization machine for their serverless function. That's written in Rust and that's running. And I know Facebook are doing their Libra digital coinage in Rust, if Libra still, I'm not sure what happened to Libra, but they certainly started doing it in Rust. And then the background to Rust is it was a Mozilla research project, so they funded it. And basically, in the same time that Mozilla failed to get multi-threaded rendering working in Firefox, they managed to invent a language, Rust, and implement it and put it in. So the core of Firefox now is Rust, certainly the rendering engine, and they're rewriting the C++ bits into Rust. So I think there's a lot of momentum behind Rust at the minute. And I think the other thing also is when you get your head around Rust, it's as expressive as something like Python. So you need less lines of codes to implement things and you don't get the very hard bugs. So before I started Flock Networks, when my manager came to me and said, how long is this going to take? You know, we used to laugh. He said, it's either 6 weeks or 6 months, you know, because he was battle scarred. He knew if I said 52 days, it would be meaningless. So he's like, is this a 6-week job or is this a 6-month job? And I would estimate, I would always be too optimistic, basically. And I have found over the last year writing in Rust, I'm about 4 months in advance of where I expected to be by this time. I just write stuff and it just works. And it's not me. It's definitely not me. It's the language. And you do sort of test-driven development. And normally in test-driven development, your tests fail to start with and you fix them up and you're convinced you're actually testing something worthwhile. And I find in Rust, half the time, I write the code, I write the test, and everything passes. And then I'm like, hang on, that test didn't run, or there's something wrong with my test. I'm not actually testing what I just implemented, because that doesn't happen. But quite often it just works first time, and I just move on to something else. And it's just like, this is just like, wow. And they say Rust is sort of production boring. So quite often people have actually put it in. It's been used in production in quite a few places. I think a lot of people are using it if they're using like Python or Ruby, and then they call into Rust for their critical section and then come back out. And there's a lot of that live. And people have said, you know, I was wary of putting it in, but since it's gone live, I haven't heard a thing. It just sits there. It does it. It's got no garbage collector. I'm not getting the stalls I used to get. And it seems pretty stable. So I think back to your question, Tom, yes, I'd like that to happen. If it did happen, I think people could develop protocols faster, and it'd be more dynamic. Obviously, it's got better unit tests and integration testing built in. Whether it will happen, I mean, the jury's out, because it's not. If it was a technical decision, it'll happen. But you know, you need to get support behind it. You need to get programmers to buy into it. And I think it'd be interesting to see the next generation of people coming out of college, whether they pick up C or will they pick up Rust, or you know, hopefully they'll learn both.
So what I've always heard is it's either two hours, 2 days, 2 weeks, or too long.
that makes all my projects too long.
So what about the user interface into this thing? I mean, are you old school, have a CLI, or are you looking primarily at Yang, or do you have something like V2ISH and FR routing, where you have a Yang interface of some type that you have a CLI that sits on top of, or how are you setting with that?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think on the operation side, I've got a good story. I think on the config side, there's still competing models, and I was hoping to wait till something sort of won out, but I think that's
too long.
Yeah. So I'll start with the operational side, which is the easy bit. So originally, I was going to do a CLI and a REST API, which is going to be read-only, so you can get state out, but you can't change anything. And actually, Ethan Banks from Packet Pushers had a try of it. There's a video on YouTube of him trying it. And everything comes back as JSON. And he's like, I want this JSON. I want to import this JSON into my Python. Can you give me the JSON? And he couldn't do it on that version. So then I thought, hang on a minute. Why have I got these two things? So then I just had a JSON REST API for everything. So you have a CLI. But when you type your CLI command, it then goes HTTP. If you're local, it goes to the local loopback. If you're remote, it goes across on a TCP connection, and it just pulls back a JSON payload, and you can choose whether you want it human formatted with extra new lines in to make it readable, or you can have it pretty printed, or you can just have it machine format. It's just quite nice. So even though there's a CLI, that just happens to use the REST API. So if you want to do automation, you can choose the language of your choice. So let's say Python, import your JSON library, connect to the router, and it just pulls it all straight down. So it's not screen scraping. It's not doing anything with text. You're just pulling down the JSON format direct into your program. And that's three lines of Python to do that. So I'm happy with the operation side. Also, it's because it's read-only and you can't change anything, you don't need any special privileges to connect to the port. So there's some sort of denial of service stuff that on the back end, so you can't flood the router with requests. But basically, you don't need special rights to go and see the state of the router, which I quite like. Obviously, the config, I think, is a whole different thing. You need certification, and you need sort of the mutability. And so I was speaking to someone else over there, actually, and their catchphrase was, the config CLI must die. And I was like, yes, I agree, the config CLI must die. So what I'd really like to do, I would like to have a minimal boot config in whatever you like, probably JSON or YAML or whatever. It doesn't really matter. For OSPF, it would be, this is your area. These are the interfaces to enable in, and maybe have a cert if you want to have some authentication. That's all you have in the boot config. And for BGP, you have the BGP AS ID and the BGP ID. So you've just got the key about which BGP peer you are, nothing else. And then I would like a management system to sit taking part in OSPF. So it receives all the Linkstay advertisements. When it gets a network in, it adds a network to its knowledge and it can allocate addresses if it needs. And if it gets a router LSA, it adds the router to its topology.
Did you just say router? router. What's going on?
I get confused. I try and translate to American and I normally fail. So that layer three switch.
There you go.
Oh, my goodness. Those terms. We have so killed our terms with routers and layer three switches, but go ahead, sorry.
Yes. But basically that management system takes part in OSPF as a full peer, and it has the full knowledge of the network. And obviously with OSPF V3, all your peers come up on your link local addressing. So you can then give out your V6, V4 global addresses from the management station. And when a BGP peer comes in, if something comes in running BGP, you can look it up on that key and say, oh, okay, what's the rest of this config? So you hold what I call the autonomous system config in that management device. And the thing then is you've got this, everyone talks about a single source of truth, but what they're doing at the moment is they're saying, I'm saying this machine has a single source of truth. But if an engineer jumps on the router and makes a change, then you haven't got a single source of truth, you've just got chaos. Whereas in the Flock model, you literally can't, you can't configure locally anything but the bare minimum. You have your single sort of truths for the autonomous system, and that gets pushed out by API to the devices. And then I also think that'd be nice because you'd have the autonomous system config checked into Git or whatever, so it's under version control. And you could also run some unit tests against the config before you deploy things. So if you wanted to check your BGP peering filters, you've got the whole config there. You could actually play route updates into your simulation.
We really don't care.
Okay, yeah. So you could actually play in your route updates and see what filters, what's taken out and what's propagated to your peers before you even deploy anything anywhere. And I think that's quite a strong selling point.
So this user interface sounds very similar. The way you've structured it is very similar to Junos. I think Junos was the first actually to do this sort of machine-only interface with something like VTYSH, which is what FR Routing does as well. Is it's basically a machine interface. I think the second one that did this was XR, from what I remember, though I'm not positive. It was SysDB. I think SysDB was the second one to do it this way. But yeah, so that's interesting because that does turn everything around, right? That makes it where you are, the first thing that you're working on is you are dealing with the machine interface. And then there is a CLI, but the CLI is only there through the machine interface. So yeah. I think that's the right thing to do nowadays. I think that's what we need to start doing.
I didn't catch in there, is the CLI read-only then, or can you still configure it locally?
You can't, no. So the CLI is just for operational state.
Nice.
And that's by design. I think the trouble is, as soon as you have a local, it's very tempting to have a local CLI config because at 2 a.m. when the network's melting down and you want to, you're the engineer on call and you're on that router and you want to stop the peering or whatever, you just want to type a command in on that router there and then and just stop the thing. But I kind of think getting in that situation is really showing the immaturity of our industry. I think if you had a centralized config and you could run your tests before you deployed it, you wouldn't be in the 2 a.m. situation unless you got a hardware failure or something. If you got a hardware failure, then you need to fix the hardware, but you can't. I can't fix that. No one can fix that. So I think the key thing there really is that those config, you because you literally can't configure things like who I'm peering with and my route filters down on the device, you have to configure them on the management system. And that's the key difference to me. As soon as you allow it in two places, you've had it.
Yeah. So I definitely agree with that philosophy. I can see people pushing back against it though and saying, well, in a poorly designed network, it's possible that a configuration problem that you pushed out cuts it off, right? And you no mm-hmm. longer have a path back to the management system to deploy. You know, I agree. This stuff should be linted. It should be checked, and then it should be deployed in, you know, in controlled circumstances. But you'll always have people that design their networks in such a way that they could do something to themselves where they cut the router off, and now the only thing you can do is console into it or whatever, and now you're dead if there's no local configuration.
But in this case, you would have that local boot that you could fix, right?
So that's
oh, I see. Yeah. You don't have to use a CLI for it, but you can still get at it locally, right?
Yes. And well, my philosophy is that your L3 needs to be peer-to-peer and autonomous, definitely. Otherwise, you've had it. But once your L3 is up, then everything else is put on top with a comping right. system. I think that's a sweet point. I think I don't have much time for the SDN controller god box, where I think if you do that, you've sort of completed the feedback loop. You're saying the network needs to boot because it needs to talk to the SDN controller, but the SDN controller needs to talk to the network to boot. And even having that model in your head as an engineer is like, well, controller's supposed to be in control here, but it can't connect. What do I do? If you say my network is autonomous to L3, and then all the nice stuff on top comes from my controller, it's a clear dividing line, right. And also it's resilient, because in that situation where it all goes horrible at 2 a.m., worst comes to worst, you power cycle the box. It comes up with OSPF, it reconnects to the controller, and off you go. So because the person at 2 a.m. is probably not the person who deployed it. If they can be told this will go back to a known state, that's what you want. Mm-hmm. If you just do this, it goes back to a known state, it'll fix itself. That's what you want to do when you get the phone call. You don't want to be logging in remotely trying to work out what's going on. You want to say, okay, we've made a mistake, put us back to a known good state, and let's just bring it back as it was.
So. Yeah, that's I like that concept a lot. The config is totally disposable. You don't care about it. It's not something that you lovingly curate, and no, it's throw it away and then reset. And
yeah, you know. But it is in version control when there is a history to why things are in there, because I spoke to quite a few customers, and loads of customers have thousands of lines of config. And even someone else told me they've got a config of an ACL, and there's a comment in the ACL, 200 lines down, that says, you must not change anything above this line. And the reason is no one knows why it's there. So that ACL is going to live forever, because nobody knows. And it's just it's just the way it is when you have individuals configuring individual devices, and engineers come and go, and everyone's doing their best, but there's no central coordination to it, and you've lost control of your network at that point. You don't change anything, because you're stuck. So yeah. How we get from there to this nirvana, I don't know. If it's a greenfield network, if you're a public cloud and you're putting in all brand new hardware, then fine, we can go and do it. But if you're an existing enterprise, it's a whole different kettle of fish to try and make that happen.
Yeah. So tell us, Nick, where people can get this, or how to get in touch with you, or if you have a blog. It sounds like you have a blog that you're putting stuff out on, or something like that.
Yeah. So flocknetworks.com is the website, and that's got everything, really. It's got the software for download. It's got the blog. It's got the white papers. It's got a bit about the company. You can get me on ncarter at flocknetworks.com. Also on LinkedIn and on Twitter under flocknetworks.com.
Okay, cool. And Tom, where can people get in touch with you?
I'm on LinkedIn and also on Twitter. I'm waiting for it.
No blog.
No, not yet.
Not soon. Yet. I'm going to talk to your new manager about that. That's what I'm going to do. Amaris White, you can always get me at rule11.tech on Twitter. Don't PM me on Twitter. People PM me all the time on Twitter, and I just don't log in. You can PM me on LinkedIn. I'm much more responsive there. Just email me. My email address is the most difficult email address in the world to find. That's why I carry hundreds and gobs of business cards with me. People ask me for business cards, and I'm like, why do you want a business card? I mean, really, you can't just go to LinkedIn and look me up and look on my contact information and find me? I mean, really, it's not that hard. I'm very easy to get a hold of. So anyway, thanks, Nick, for coming on. It's been a great conversation about Flock Networks, and I hope that you get it open source soon.
I hope so, too.
So we can keep talking to you.
Because otherwise you're cut off.
How long have I got?
5 minutes. No. All right. We'll catch y'all later. Have a great day.
Thanks for us. Thanks, Tom.
Subscribe to The Hedge on your favorite podcast service or follow along at rule11.tech.